Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm John Wilson. Welcome to These Three, a series in which I talk to artists, musicians, writers, directors, actors, photographers, all sorts of creative people, in fact, about their artistic lives by focusing on three key works, one that they made themselves, that they're particularly proud of, one by somebody else that they wish they'd made, and one that they're working on right now.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Yeo, and I'm going to tell you about the painting I made, the painting I wish I'd made, and the painting I'm working on at the moment.
We're in West London, in a back street of Chelsea, a beautiful studio, and you've been here for several years now, and this studio has heritage in itself. It used to belong to the great Scottish-Italian sculptor, pop artist, Eduardo Paolozzi. I actually came to the studio. I interviewed Paolozzi many years ago here.
It's a funny thing with spaces. I've had grander, madder studios in the past, but this one somehow has a great energy in it for making work, and that may well be what... I think he was here for 40 years before I was, and so it may well be why... It's hard to put your finger on what it is. It's partly the light coming from different places. It shouldn't work. It's a sculptor's studio, not a painter's studio. The light's coming from all the wrong places. But I quite like that when I'm trying to illuminate a subject in interesting ways and sometimes do things... You find things by accident that you wouldn't have thought of in advance.
Your paintings are very well known because very often the subjects are very well known. Mm. For those who don't know your work, and I'm just glancing around, I can see a portrait of Maxine Peake up there. There's Idris Elba, Damien Hirst looking down upon us.
Dennis Hopper.
A
couple of others.
Is that Cara Delevingne over there?
There's a Cara and Helena Bonham Carter. Basically, there are lots of little studies for bigger works which have sadly left my life. But it's nice to have little souvenirs of some of the, you know, it's a mad cross-section of people who come through.
But you are known primarily as a portraitist. What is it about the face? Have you got a particular fascination? And does it mean that when you meet people, you are always focusing in a way on a face that maybe the rest of us, in a way that we don't? Are you looking for something else? Because actually, I should also say that your paintings are not just about visual representation. It's about a suggestion of what lies beneath. That's really what you're trying to get to, isn't it?
Yes. So traditionally, a portrait is where you're trying to tell a story about someone. It's like a potted biography through their appearance. And I think that photography obviously can tell you what someone looked like at that moment. You've got the sort of luxury of having more time with people. And sometimes you see things where they're not conscious of being looked at before you start, or after you finish and you go out for lunch and you see them behaving in a certain way, because we're generally not one-dimensional people. And I think the fun of a portrait is you get a chance to layer in different sides to someone's personality. Mm. And therefore, almost by definition, the more complex the personality is to start with, the more fun you can have with the painting.
And also there's a backstory sometimes hinted at in the painting. Famously, you painted Tony Blair. It was after the Iraq War, and you painted him with a poppy, a symbol of piece. Was he wearing that poppy when he was sitting for you?
Yes, he was actually, and I took a lot of the credit for that because it was at the end of his time in office, and it's politicians tend to be remembered for the events and things that happen to them rather than what they're planning at the start.
And all politicians' careers end in failure, famously.
Yes, exactly, yeah, especially at the moment. But I'd been slightly paralysed by indecision about what to do with this one, because that was a great opportunity in a way, because we knew that he was likely to be remembered for his foreign policy. But at the same time, I didn't want to make it trite or preachy or any of this, fall into any of the obvious traps. It was November, and he came in wearing a poppy, and I was like, oh, wow, I hadn't thought of that. And he was like, oh, should I take this off? I was like, no, don't worry, I can always leave it out of the painting if we don't need it. But I spotted that instantly. And the nice thing is, from a purely visual point of view, it's a great counterpoint to the painting, which is all blues and greys, really. And it's, at a glance, it could be blood on his lapel. And there were various other little references, changing the Labour red flag to a red rose and all that sort of thing. But basically, it's obviously a very European thing that we recognise that as a sort of symbol of war remembrance. I thought I'd left it ambiguous about whether he was looking defiant or remorseful, but most people seem to read it as just him being sort of pinned down as a warmonger.
That was probably the second time you painted Blair, wasn't it? I first came across you when you did a series of portraits, three portraits, Tony Blair, William Hague, and Charles Kennedy, the leaders of the three main parties during the... So it wasn't the 97 election, was it? 2001 election campaign, and that was an official parliamentary commission. I think it was Tony Banks, wasn't he, who chaired the Culture Committee or whatever in Parliament. And that was a great commission. And three really interesting portraits. Having grown up in a political household, for those who don't know your father, Timothy Yeo, Tory MP, did you have a particular fascination with politics? And were you trying to bring that together with the art?
I think I was certainly conscious of having grown up around some political figures and being very interested in the personality side of it. I think that people tend to sort of see things in terms of ideas and slightly caricatures from afar. Mm. But actually, I was always interested in the idea of how individual personalities affected decisions that were being made and how things played out, sometimes not in ways that are obvious on the outside. And I think that, also you realise that I think we tend to polarise people, politicians especially, people in the public eye, as, good or bad, black or white. And actually, there's, a whole range in between. And I was very interested in that. People go into politics with good intentions, but then they have to make compromises and sometimes bad decisions.
And often wear a mask in public as well.
You're
trying to strip that mask away, I guess, with those portraits.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, but at the same time, it was hanging around the idea of an election. It was one of the sort of earlier works where I was trying to have a parallel to conceptual idea, if you like, that it was about how well they did. So, I called it proportional representation.
They were all different sizes, weren't they, those portraits?
Exactly. And that was a bit of a way of telling that story. And so, it comes back to what you were saying before. I think that, if you can tell a story about the wider picture at the same time without it overwhelming the painting and getting in the way, then that's the more layers a work can have, especially a portrait, the better, I think.
You didn't go to art school, famously. Mm. When did you first pick up a paintbrush? When did you realise that you could do it?
Well, I think it probably goes back to when I was at school and had what's now recognised as probably a severe case of ADD.
That's attention deficit disorder.
Exactly.
What, you just couldn't concentrate on anything, one particular thing.
Yeah, well, you couldn't choose what you concentrated on. But oddly, the two things that would help concentration for people who have that, one is having music playing, which obviously wasn't possible in class. But the other thing is to be doing something you're interested in my case, drawing. And so I found that the lessons I was allowed to draw through, I would actually hear what was going on and remember it. The ones where I was told to stop because I wasn't concentrating and I then couldn't remember a thing because my mind would wander all over the place. So it was actually, they had a practical side to it, but also meant that I was very often drawing the teachers and caricaturing them because that way I was looking at them, had the extra benefit that it would make my friends laugh and they thought it was cool. But therefore, actually, that was probably quite useful training to be doing a lot of that in my teens. And I didn't set out to be a portrait painter. I I had lots of ideas about different kinds of things I wanted to do, but it was something that I could do fairly easily. It was very out of fashion at the time, in the early, mid-90s. And so,
the YBA movement, conceptual art came back in.
Exactly. And I mean, I loved all that work, and I had eclectic taste. But obviously, I also had to make a living. And so portraits were one thing which I could do quite easily. And so that was the way I could afford to pay my way through the learning curve of my 20s.
By now, you've probably painted hundreds, possibly thousands of portraits. I mean, have you got any idea how many works that you've made?
Certainly, I think several hundred.
Several hundred.
I probably do about 20 or 30 sort of proper paintings a year.
Just looking around, I mean, there are dozens here in the studio in various states of... Well, some of them are finished and framed, and others are stacked against the wall. And, I mean, it's just a fantastic studio, this, because there are the paintbrushes all lined up in order and a huge pile of oil paints there in front of a canvas that you're obviously midway through. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But let's start with the painting I made.
It's a tricky thing because you obviously, a lot of these things are a result of a lot of thought and effort and a labour of love. Sometimes the ones that seem most magical are the ones that seem to come out of nowhere. I think one that probably has more significance than most, partly because he was a friend of mine, partly because it was the sort of main work in a little retrospective I had at the National Portrait Gallery a few years ago, was Damien Hirst. Anyway, it's interesting painting other artists because you've got that added layer of the fact of them being vaguely, loosely in the same business and a bit of pressure, if you like, because you feel that they've got a more scrutinizing eye than some and people will be making comparisons. Obviously, the fun of it was that he's a playful person and so was interested in doing something unusual. His work is very different from mine. He's a great contemporary sculptor. I think the things he was originally best known for and still spends a lot of time on are his animals in vitrines, or the more recent stuff, which is a hybrid sort of work on a grand scale. So it was a fun opportunity, and the painting sort of evolved from him coming to the studio, me going to his studio, trying to get some ideas. They were doing some of the formaldehyde work one day, which gave me the idea. We talked about it in the studio. He said, I could put on one of the dry suits if you like. And being Damien, he made a call in about 20 minutes, someone dropped one round. And he squeezed himself into this incredible sort of rubber suit.
To protect himself from the formaldehyde.
Exactly. So that's what he used back in the day when he actually went into the tanks to make the work.
And he looks like a deep sea diver.
Yes. Well,
that's the weird thing, isn't it?
It's a nice ambiguous thing, I think, that as soon as I saw it, you could read it as at a glance, because it's got this gas mask as well. And some people thought he was some sort of kind of paramilitary sort of riot policeman. Others, as you say, thought he was a diver. That was enhanced by the fact that I painted it in slightly formaldehyde colours and tried to give it the impression of him maybe being submerged in one of those tanks himself. And then, obviously, once I'd made that connection, then to put in a slight suggestive framework of a tank, which is also had a slightly sort of Francis Bacon look,
absolutely.
Minimalist construction.
Yeah. I thought when I saw that painting, that is a reference to Francis Bacon. That's Damien in one of his own vitrines. But of course, Bacon himself would often do that. His subjects were sitting within a glass case. And of course, Francis Bacon is a massive hero of Damien's. I mean, there's a kind of a circularity there, isn't there?
Exactly. And we'd been talking about Bacon as well. So that's probably partly why it was in my head. And I think the expression on it is mildly is somewhere between controlling and cheeky, if that sounds possible. The pose makes him feel like he's sort of like slightly above you, yet the sort of expression is definitely some mischievous. The idea was to sort of like the question mark about whether he's there making one of his own works or whether he's been made into one.
Very good.
And so it was one of those nice occasions where actually sometimes you start a painting with a fixed idea and that's what comes out. But it's also, there are other times when something evolves as you're working on it. And this is one of those. I didn't know at the start how it would end up. because of that, possibly, the multiple stories sort of woven into it, which I think makes it something people, I notice, spend a lot of time in the museum looking at it. Yeah, the main thing, you want these works to be seen. And so that one's certainly one of the ones that sort of is the first one that gets asked for whenever I'm doing a portrait show anywhere.
How do you know, well, there's two questions. How do you know when a painting is finished? Because I guess the temptation is to keep going and going. Mm. And actually, the interesting thing with many of your paintings is you concentrate on the eyes, the face, the nose, the hair, but very often the background, and even, I don't know, the texture of a shirt or some kind of artifacts that are around that give a suggestion of who that person is, are often sketched in and unfinished or blurred or slightly distorted. So at some point you just think, it is finished, but how do you know when that point arrives? Is it instinctive?
It's a good question. I'm not sure I always get it right either. I definitely overwork some and wish I could undo them. Yeah, when we look at a scene, we don't take it all in painstaking detail. We see other humans in the your frame of view are the most immediate thing. And yeah, probably people who are listening can test this out. But yeah, if you glance at something and glance away, the things that stay in your mind are the face, if there's another person there, or body language, if there are people. Body language is important as well. We make judgments about the situation, whether someone's a threat or a friend or, you know, any number of things in between, what their mood is, what's likely to happen next, their age, their gender, all kinds of things in a nanosecond, you know, without having to think about it. Yeah. We just compute all these things because that goes back so far in our DNA. We don't check out every detail of the room. We get a sense of their body shape and their clothing without getting all the details. And it's very interesting, actually. I've been working with some technology companies recently, exploring how our mind sees things as opposed to how the cameras see things. And it's definitely, I think they're coming around to this idea that we are selectively editing in a very sophisticated way. And although I didn't know that at the time, my work, I guess, was based on the assumption that something like that was going on. And obviously, I do a massively exaggerated version of it. Yeah. But I think that in the future, we may find ways of representing things through technology that may be a bit closer to that slightly collagey way of painting.
That's interesting. I mean, it's what Picasso was doing, of course, with cubism. We are not looking at everything at the same time. And just looking at you here now in front of me, and I can see aspects of the studio around, but it is distorted. The peripheral vision is unclear, and it keeps coming and going. It's broken up. I mean, but as you say, that's sort of an unconscious decision. You didn't set out to do that with the paintings. You just instinctively happened to be tapping into that.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
So that was the first part of the question. The second part of the question was going to be, how do you know when a painting is good? I mean, what point is the, does the satisfaction... I mean, why that Damien one? Why did that one work and other ones don't?
That's a good question. I don't think you always do know when the work's good or not. Some, quite a few works I've done which I thought were great, I now look back on and realise that wasn't the case. And sometimes people told me at the time, I just chose not to listen. But I think also, and there's a flip side, which is sometimes, you know, things get better with time. I think you have a funny thing when you're making, doing anything creative, which is you obviously start off with some sort of intention. And if the work that comes out fulfills that, you maybe see it as a success. Or if it doesn't, then you don't value it in the same way as you might. And sometimes you only realise coming back to things ages afterwards that something was actually much more interesting than even you intended because of the accidents that happened while you were making it. So anyway, it's a bit of a long-winded way of explaining. With that one, I just felt that it had a power from the start. And I think a square canvas, which is interesting, square canvases are didn't exist really in art before the 20th century. We now got very used to them because of social media, as well as Warhol and lots of 20th century artists doing them. But they are a very... The reason I know this is because I used to buy antique frames at one point because I was doing collages and trying to make the look of old paintings. And that you couldn't buy antique frames in the square shape.
Right.
They had landscape, which was wide, or portrait, which is upright, and that was that. And so, but it's interesting, I think square pictures do seem to have a power to them, like all the kind of perspective dynamics converge on whatever you're doing. So that I think that painting I knew was going to be strong, but obviously the more it went on, the more fun we were having, the more layered into it, I had a good feeling about it.
So the painting I made, the portrait of Damien Hirst, the painting I wish I'd made. I mean, this is a tough one, isn't it? And I'm giving you, you know, you could pick anything from history. It could be a cave painting that's, 100,000 years old. Or it could be something that was done last week.
It's really difficult. You mentioned Picasso, which is funny enough. I think the one I had in mind, because it had a sort of powerful effect on me at a sort of formative age. You're absolutely right about how difficult it is, because there are often mesmerizingly extraordinary things about art that's been done recently, that's done 500 years ago. I was in Rome last week looking at paintings over there, which I thought I knew, but I hadn't really realized just how extraordinary they were. And I also actually in recent years been very conscious of how slightly distorted our view of art history is through the prism of the Western art history, which is canonized lots of Caucasian European artists who were the ones who were able to indulge their careers more easily than other groups. And actually, I remember early on sort of discovering Frida Kahlo and Alice Neal and Gwen John, especially the sort of subtle power of some of those, and I couldn't believe that they weren't a bigger deal. The thing that had a sort of steering effect on me was seeing a Picasso portrait of Ambroise Vollard, I think it was, who was his dealer at the time. And this is when he was going through his sudden, massive cubist phase in around 1910, 1912, when he went from painting these, quite nice neoclassical sort of blue and pink periods, which I think maybe slightly overrated, but then to this thing where he suddenly worked out that the world could be seen in a different way. And that sort of revolution, which he was right in the middle of, was such an extraordinary thing at the time. And I think people didn't know how to really deal with it. And this was a portrait which, from a distance, you can quite clearly see that it's supposed to be a portrait of a man, and you get an idea of what he looked like. And the more closer you get to it, the more broken up and distorted it is, and you can't believe it made so much sense from a distance. And that it's sort of like an easy way into understanding that phase of distortion and seeing the world in different ways. Cubism is in a nutshell, was about taking multiple viewpoints rather than just one. And I guess it was like reaction to the takeover of photography in the early 20th century.
Well, it's what actually a lot of the digital photography now, particularly that stuff that you can do on your phone. And recently you showed me something you can do on your new smartphone, which is to take a 3D scan and to represent, and then it's shown on the screen as a 3D head. Picasso, in effect, was doing that 100 years ago.
Yes, in a sense. I think that was absolutely that idea of piecing things together, you know, and playing with the depths and three-dimensionality in a totally new way. I think that, as you say, that suddenly we've gone in the last couple of years to having things on some of the newest phones, which, and that's going to massively increase, I think, in the next few years. There's another revolution potentially coming in terms of three-dimensional artworks, whether it's actual physical artworks or virtual artworks, which seem to be there and as real as something that is there. And I think that to really explore and really make use of this, of all these new ways of making work using three dimensions in an entirely new way. And so I think I wouldn't be surprised if in 5 or 10 years' time there's a whole lot of work which completely changed our view of the world again.
There we are. So the portrait that Johnny Yeo wishes he had painted. I mean, it's a silly thing to ask, really, isn't it? Because you weren't around 100 years ago. But it's a painting which means something to you, which has had some kind of influence. Picasso's portrait of Ambroise Vollard. That was his name, was it?
Yeah.
Okay. Where is that painting? Do you know?
It might be in the Picasso Museum in Paris. I think it was on loan to a cubism show, because there were a couple of great cubism shows when I was around the time I was leaving school,
right,
which had a great effect on me. And I think that one, I think, just was the one which certainly influenced my work very rapidly afterwards.
Very often when you talk to an artist, whether it's a visual artist or a musician, a writer, filmmaker, and you say, you know, what's your best work? They say the next one. So the question is, the painting I'm making, I mentioned it at the beginning of our chat. It's here in front of us. You're going to talk about this portrait that you're making at the moment. At first glance, it looks a lot like Elton John in his 1970s pomp. What is that? It's like a sort of like feather wings.
Yes.
And a gold suit with flames and devil horns.
Yes.
And heart-shaped, rose-tinted glasses. It's not Elton John, but it's close. Who is that?
My friend Dexter Fletcher has been making the movie Rocket Man, which you probably all know about now. And it's Taron, who I've got to know. They were sort of teasing me with this idea of doing a painting of him in character. And I went down to see them a few times on set and realised it was actually possibly a very interesting thing to do, not least because obviously I like him and them, and I love the outfit, as you say. I mean, it's not often you get to paint an outfit that's quite so flamboyant and ridiculous as that. I haven't even put the sequins on the suit yet.
So that's Taron Egerton as Elton John on the set of Rocket Man. And he is incredible. I mean,
he's incredible.
He sings in it, doesn't
he? Yeah, he's got such charisma. He's a lovely man. And we've had a lot of fun doing this. Obviously, he's taken a risk singing it himself as well. He didn't have to do that. But he carries that off amazingly. There's an incredible chemistry between the actors on the film. It was one of the things I picked up. And then, obviously, all Dexter's films look beautiful as well. I think the film is amazing, and there's lots to enjoy in it. From my point of view, with the painting, it goes back to what we were saying before about trying to capture someone's identity, really, in a painting. The whole premise of portrait painting, Lucian Freud used to say, is that you have to believe that people are what they look like. That's the sort of portrait painter's credo. You have to believe that everything you need to know about someone can be worked out from their appearance. The thing I've noticed over the years painting actors is that actors are there for a more problematic subject than most, possibly politicians as well, but because they are pretending to be someone else using those same tools by how they move their face, how they dress, and who they're pretending to be outwardly. And therefore, there's a slight sort of paradox, which is that obviously you're interested in a great actor because of what they've done before, but whatever they're doing now is the better they are, the more successful they are at misleading you into thinking there's someone new this time.
That's really interesting. I spoke to David Bailey the other day, and I said, of all the people you photograph, whether that's politicians or models and film stars and directors and other photographers, who is the hardest in terms of professional groupings, the hardest type of person? He said always actors.
Yes,
he said, because you never know who they are. Huh. And they're always in the middle of a role, and there's something about the role that they're playing at that moment that they bring to the studio, and you have to try and somehow strip away that mask. So is it the same trying to paint an actor then, do you think?
I totally understand what he means, and I think photographers have a harder job in a way, because they've got to do it in one session. I find usually what happens is everyone, actually, not just actors, wear a bit of a mask, and they usually get more comfortable the second or third time you see them.
Yeah, the mask drops with you, I guess, over a period of time, doesn't it?
Exactly. I don't envy the job of a photographer, and I think sometimes, obviously, Bailey's a great one at sort of cutting through things in conversation and making people sort of like, lose their...
He charms the mask off.
Yeah,
usually,
exactly. You're never quite sure, even if they are... not in character, that they're not just playing the part of the artist model that day, What's unusual about this picture is, of course, that the character he's playing is someone we also know from the real world. Again, he's playing him very convincingly. We do know that he's Taron, but at the same time, we are registering so many signs of Elton. And it's a very interesting thing. So this question of where is there a tipping point where he stops being himself and starts becoming the character? That's obviously the case with all actors. But I think with this one, because we also know the end point, we know what he's trying to do, and so more aware of it. And I think the idea was for him not to be in full performance mode, but to be slightly, kind of looking slightly introspective or distracted, as if it's not clear whether he's, the actor waiting to go on stage or Elton waiting to go on into a performance. I think the ambiguity of that makes it a bit more intriguing.
And also the multi-layered aspect, because that's Taron Egerton playing Elton John at a period of his life when really Elton John was a character who was played by Reg Dwight. Yes. I mean, it's got that kind of, where is the real character within that painting? Who is the real person there?
Well, that's a nice point, actually, because I think Elton is one of those amazing performers who definitely goes into performance mode and then is a sort of slightly sort of different person off stage. And so he has that as well. So it's a sort of, it's a multiple story about, I think, the complexities of being a performer, but also the job of doing, making a portrait of someone where it's not quite clear who they are or who they're trying to be.
So how far are you off finishing this painting? It's that whole question again, isn't it? When is a painting finished?
The thing is, also, I've been kind of, I keep going away and leaving it and then coming back and deciding it's not right. There's always a slight chance I might just start it all over again. But I think that it's pretty close. I just, like you were saying, my instinct is to go minimal with paintings and only give you the information you absolutely need. I got quite excited about the ridiculousness of the outfit with this one. And all the outfits have been designed as a mashup of his stage outfits from the 70s by a brilliant costume designer. Julian Day. The costumes in the film are amazing.
Yeah.
This one is one that recurs. There's so many different things going on. I just have gone, what's the opposite of minimalism? I don't know. It's
maximalism.
Yeah, it's a glam, exactly. A glamorous overloading of detail. And it's, it's a lot of fun doing something different.
And how often are you in here working, not just on this painting, but other ones? Is it a 9-to-5 thing? Do you have to get in at a certain time every day? Is there a working routine in this place?
I think most artists would probably tell you the same thing, which is, you can't be sure which days are going to be the most productive.
Right.
But unless you're here for a lot, for early enough to take advantage of it, when it is a good day, then you're missing too many opportunities. And so, I also have family. I tend to, treat it like a day. When I'm in London, I'm here every day. And if it's going well, I'll work into the evening. If it's not, I'll pack up and go home early.
Wonderful. It's looking fantastic. So I better get out your way, let you get on with Taran as Reg, as Elton. When do you give a title to a painting, by the way? Do most of your paintings have titles, or are they just the name of the sitter?
It varies a bit. I think when there's a bit more of a story, they sometimes have a bit more of a sort of unplayful title.
So that comes yeah. Later.
It's usually when someone's putting a catalogue or book to bed, and I haven't given something to someone yet. It's usually done retrospectively. Although sometimes it kind of comes along the way, and sometimes people offer suggestions.
Johnny, thanks so much for that. Back to the painting, I guess, for you, is it?
Yes, I need to get this one finished. I'm going away again. And there are, as you can see, lots of other ones that need to be started. But thank you. It's great to see you.
You too. Thanks very much. And if you enjoyed Jonathan Yeo, have a listen to the other episodes featuring the likes of Paul Weller, Hayley Atwell, Tom O'Dell, Lucy Prebble, Kwame Kweama, Guy Garvey, and there are many more on the way. Please do rate and review these three, and it helps other people find the series. And subscribe so that you don't miss an episode. Also, have a look at the website. We've got more information about all of the guests. There are photographs, videos, previews of forthcoming episodes. We're on Twitter and Instagram, of course. These Three is produced and presented by me, John Wilson, in association with Analog Folk. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds. Like the breathable, silky smooth tree dasher, the responsive foam and extra grip of the tree runner, or the classic low-top look of the tree piper. Allbirds has a lightweight, ultra-packable shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.